Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? I missed you terribly over the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yes, we took the week off. This Week in Blog did not come in last week, so we are back taping the week after Thanksgiving. And again, I'm Con Carroll, the official blogger of the Heritage Foundation.
I'm Bill Scherer, blogger for Campaign for America's Future and Liberal Oasis. You also blog at The Next Right, I believe.
I do. I'm not an editor there, though. I mean, the Soren and Patrick and Hankey and Matt Moon, they can post stuff on the front page if they want. But I have to write what I want and then sell it to them to get it promoted to get it up there. So I contribute, but it's not my baby.
So, big excitement for bloggers in the conservative blogosphere, a victory in Georgia.
Yes. I don't know if it's super excitement, but...
Red State was excited.
Eric was excited. But it's a bit more of a home state win for him. He's down there and making himself, so...
A favorite blog headline on the left was from Fire Dog Lake's Blue Texan. Eric Erickson dances in end zone after a late field goal by Saxby Chambliss makes final score 48-3.
Yes. I always like Fire Dog Lake for their good headlines and humor.
So what is the general attitude? I mean, is it a sense of saving grace, or is it a shrug of the shoulders that, well, this was expected in the first place?
No, I think there is more of a, Sean Oxendine at The Next Right, which you mentioned, had a good post, which kind of summed up my feelings. He had four main points. First of all, he said, this election is only a data point, but it is a useful data point. Chambliss actually received about 200,000 more votes than he received in 2002 midterm election, while Martin received about as many votes as Cleland did that year. In other words, I'm more comfortable with using this election as a data point than I am with using most other special elections. Second point was the Save the Filibuster is a useful slogan for 2010. He notes that polling data show that a good chunk of Martin's voters were concerned enough about the prospect of a filibuster-proof Democratic majority to call into question whether they would vote for him. Three was that Obama had coattails, which should make the Democrats nervous about 2010 when he's not going to be on top of the ticket. And the fourth point is that the real test is Saturday. There's another runoff, or special election, Republican versus Democrat, in the fourth congressional district of Louisiana. And Sean writes, Democrats, after all, were winning open seats in the South with regularity before 2006-2008. But if Republicans win Louisiana district by more than a couple of points, combined with the Chambliss result, we will begin to have some good evidence that the anti-Republican backlash of the last few years has really begun to subside. I think, that pretty much sums it up. It's a data point. It's not something to get overly excited about, but I think it might show a turning of the tide that, with Bush's name coming off the top of the ticket, it's like a huge, huge anchor has been lifted around Republicans' necks. So things are looking up.
Both Nate Silver at 538 and Chris Bowers at Open Left also took a note of caution from that, and I think Bowers' point has a lot of merit. Last night's results at a different Democracy Corps poll, which talked about slight pluralities, nervous that Congress would be too much of a rubber stamp to Obama. So the country isn't going to dump on Republicans forever. There's no grace period when the country will still vote for Democrats just because they hate Republicans. Democratic hopes in 2010, 2012 rest entirely on our governing record during the next 2 to 4 years. And I think that's largely right.
How can it not be?
Well, right. I mean, it's somewhat of a basic. But, I mean, there's a chance, over time if Democrats establish a certain amount of credibility and Republican credibility was shot, then you could stand to have some imperfect years and not, lose, all of Washington. But this is it's too early for that. But I'd also recall, I believe Reagan lost seats in Republicans lost seats in Congress in 1982.
Right, coming off of a recession.
There was a recession then.
Right.
But over the four-year period, Reagan's record was seen as better than his predecessor's, Jimmy Carter's, and he won in a landslide. So... even though there's going to be a certain difficulty in showing a lot of tangible economic improvement over a short window of time because the hole is so deep. It's a possibility that if things are going to pan out better in 4 years than two, losing in 2010 doesn't automatically mean losing in 2012. Now, I'm not even that pessimistic about 2010, but it's always difficult to extrapolate too much out of one election.
Right, right. But, you know, I think I what I saw in both Nate's and Chris' posts was the acknowledgement that, you know, the toxicity of the Republican brand is, with Bush leaving, is rapidly wearing off. And that, you know, as great as Obama did, there hasn't been a ton of correlation melding of the Obama and Democratic brand. And then what we saw in 2008 was really an Obama victory, whatever that means, and not a hard left Democrat victory.
Well, that's a lot of extrapolating on your part, I might argue. But, we don't have to go too deep into that.
Well, let's look at the Democracy Course poll, which is, of course, run by two Democratic pollsters, mm-hmm. the one that Chris cites.
All right.
And you know, the two questions are, you know, what are you more concerned with? That Congress will prevent Barack Obama from making the kinds of changes that are needed, or that Democratic Congress will become too much of a rubber stamp. And the people that were worried about the Democrats becoming a rubber stamp were 49%. And then when you slightly changed the question and made it, I'm more concerned that Republicans in Congress will obstruct Barack Obama's agenda versus I'm more concerned that Democrats in Congress will be too much of a rubber stamp. It's pretty much the same result, 43-48. So, you know, it definitely shows that there is a lot of that. As bad as the Republican brand is under Bush, the American public has not wholeheartedly embraced the Democratic brand.
Well, I mean, I think that latter part you say is true. There, Democrats have been given a chance, but I think that's a different thing than saying that the toxicity of the Republican brand has already dissipated just because a victory would happen in Georgia, number one. And number two, that Democracy Corps question doesn't talk at all about specific policy ideas and where the public stands on that from an ideological perspective. You have a USA Today Gallup poll. I mean, the first thing out of the box is going to be a major economic recovery plan package, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a second, that by any definition would be a progressive left-of-center package. We're talking about a significant amount of government investment. We don't know what the number is going to be yet, but the parameters of the discourse are talking about between, you know, big and really big.
Right.
USA Today Gallup poll this week, you know, said, do you think we need to have, you know, a big government stimulus plan? And that won 58-33. So the point of the Democracy Corps poll is, I think, is a general skepticism of consolidation of too much power into one person. A general fear that things might be taken too far. There's not, again, a deep reservoir of trust. Just, you know, the guy's not even president yet. But he's still achieving, you know, pretty stratospheric approval numbers during the transition and pretty widespread support for his main policy plank on day one. Not a bad place to start, and certainly not any kind of deep reservation about the general ideological direction he's going in.
Yeah, that's true to a certain extent. I just want to go quickly back to Georgia Senate to go back to another Matt Stoller post. He wrote, I'll note that there is an increasing likelihood that the Republicans are going to shed some of their big business allegiances and retreat into a much more nativist mode. I know this sounds crazy, but hear me out. First of all, Saxby Chambliss gave Sarah Palin credit for his victory last night. Palin uses the term good union job to describe her husband's work, and generally operates as a reactionary populist. He goes on, foundations are devastated because of endowment losses leading to nonprofit cutbacks, corporations are cutting back on lobbying, and advertising sales at the sustained mainstream conservative media are crashing. The right-wing infrastructure is probably going to face some serious cutbacks as rich people and companies find their wealth evaporating. In other words, it's going to become cheaper to organize people than money, which will help populists across the board. That means Republicans might morph into a fully nativist populist party during a prolonged economic slump, and big business will invest relatively more in the Democratic Party.
Do you think that's an accurate assessment of the conservative movement?
There is a lot there I think is accurate, and there's a lot there I think is 100% wrong. The accurate part is that the Republicans are going to get more populist, and they are going to shed some big business allegiances, but not in the way that Matt sees it. I think, you know, you see Sarah talking about good union jobs, and it's good that she does that. You know, Reagan always said, you know, I was a union member. But at the same time,
but you don't like unions.
I don't like union leadership. I don't like union leadership that forces members' dues from workers and spends hundreds of million dollars trying to elect Democrats or you know unions.
But you like the basic principle that workers should be allowed to organize and collectively bargain for good wages and benefits.
If they had the option of also not joining the union, I would support that idea. Unfortunately, that's not the legal regime we exist under. But going on, I don't think you're going to see I think what Sarah's rhetoric shows is the same kind of better rhetoric that Reagan had of saying, you know, union workers are good, union workers are strong, we're not against union workers, we're against union leadership. So you are going to see a softening of that tone, but you're not going to see any type of movement going towards more restrictionist policies, et cetera. But I do think you are going to see a more libertarian populism. You know, look at the broad success of the Ron Paul campaign. You know, Ron Paul's not exactly a charismatic guy. It's not like that movement took off because Ron Paul gives great speeches. Soren Dayton, who writes over the Next Right, said, you know, one of the big travesties looking back on the GOP campaign in 2008 was the way the party itself treated the Ron Paul voters, and that there was, you know, a legitimate, organic, libertarian populist movement that had money, had a message, had strength, and instead of working with it and adopting some of its ideas and bringing it into the tent, it was, you know, the Republican establishment tried to just, you know, strangle it in the grave. So I do think you are going to see a shift away from kind of a big business more to a libertarian populism. So, you know, not necessarily the direction that Matt would have it going. The second point where I just think he's dead wrong is, number one, that corporations are cutting back on lobbying. That's just not true. If you look at any of the reporting coming out of The Hill, The New York Times, Roll Call, businesses, knowing that the Democrats are coming into power, Democrats, you know, exist to control the economy and funnel as much power as they can through Washington. And, of course,
you know what he was citing?
Who was citing?
What Stoller was citing?
He didn't have a link there. He didn't have any link there.
That's just chatter he's heard.
That's just chatter. But everything I've been reading is that actually corporations have been pouring more money into lobbying. Now, of course, they're spending a lot more of it on Democrats. I hear Democrats on the Hill are, you know, fetching around $200,000, $250,000 as a starting salary at lobbying firms. But, yeah, there's a mad scramble on corporate America to pour money into K Street because, you know, you talked about that. I don't think you put a number on it, but I've heard anywhere from $500 billion to $1 trillion. Corporations are going to want a slice of that, and they're going to be willing to plunk down some money to get as much of it as possible.
It'll be interesting to see how successful they are.
Oh, I think they'll be plenty successful.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that's true.
But yeah, they're already getting tons of the bailout money. But, yeah, I mean, the rest of it, you know, foundations are devastated because of endowment losses. I'm sure that's true, but I'm not hearing – I mean, he says there are nonprofit cutbacks. I haven't heard of any. Right-wing infrastructure is probably going to face serious cutbacks.
The National Association of Manufacturers is experiencing cutbacks.
It's true, but that would be more of the corporations, not of they're an industry.
They're
an industry nonprofit. I mean, they're an industry trade group, not a foundation nonprofit like
that functions very much as a lobbying
right. outfit. And then he also says advertising sales that sustain mainstream conservative media are crashing. That actually is true, but I don't think that's just true for mainstream conservative media. I think advertising revenue for pretty much everyone is crashing. So, you know, you are going to see a lot more grassroots organizing going along. I just don't think it's going to be in quite the direction that Matt says it's going to be in.
Well, it'll be interesting if the libertarian populist tone is what dominates when we're going to, in all likelihood, have a pretty significant government investment, public investment package defining the course of the next 2 years at least. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, whether that works or not is going to be a pretty dominating factor in what happens electorally. If conservatives bet on anti-government libertarianism and the increased public investment is perceived to be working, that could put conservatives out on the fringes for a very long time.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the big ideological bet we're going to see here.
There's been a number of posts lately on the left trying to, get our arms around what this package should look like. There's a debate over how big, and there's a debate over what should be in it. My own boss at Campaign for America's Future, Bob Borisod, she had a post up at Huffington Post as well as our site, ourfuture.org, where he talks about Obama's chief economic advisor, Larry Summers, who suggests, quote, a speedy, substantial, and sustained fiscal stimulus at levels of $350 billion a year or more. A key question is whether the stimulus will be strategic, investing in areas vital to our future rather than simple one-off expenditures for temporary effect. Matt Iglesias talks about this as well. This is one reason why I think it's important for a stimulus package to have a heavy element of aid to state and local government and related agencies. The federal government contains a lot of automatic stabilizers. Spending keeps going even though revenues fall. That should act as stimulus, but those stabilizers are offset by the pro-cyclical nature of the state and local budget practices. Federal promise of aid will forestall state and local budget cuts, thus allow automatic stabilizers to work. All that can be mobilized in a rapid time scale. Somewhat similarly, the federal government could pledge funds to transit agencies in order to finance fare cuts rather than contractionary combination of fare acts and service cuts that we're currently looking at. Add a few tens of billions of dollars worth of shovel-ready infrastructure projects and you might be getting somewhere. Sterling Newberry at Fire Dog Lake, in referring to the news that we've already been in a recession for a full year, talks about what a disaster it shows that last year's stimulus was, which was essentially rebate checks. So that helps bolster the argument for public investment in tangible things, as well as state and local government aid so they can keep providing services. That's the direction we seem to be going in. And the question becomes exactly what those projects are, making sure they're being decided on a meritorious basis, not on a lobbyist-driven, earmarked pork barrel basis. In fact, there was a Heritage Post I saw saying no earmarks in the stimulus package, and that's something that I would fully – I think it was the first Heritage Post I ever agreed with. Because if this needs – for it to work, it needs to be done in a merit-based way and less so in a political way.
Yeah. I guess I don't hear a lot of coherence there. I mean, on the one hand, you're saying we need to get this money out the door as fast as possible, but on the other hand, you're saying we need to build this magical box that's going to make sure all the money is invested wisely and not based on lobbying or other political ideas. I guess my question is, is there a coherent plan that's being pushed in order to make sure that happens?
I can only presume that's what the transition team is working on right now. We haven't been privy to the specifics yet. They've only outlined basic principles. We had a story in the New York Times today about the green stimulus component of it. I know you love the green-collar jobs. It's your favorite topic.
It's now annoying me a lot less that it's all going to be wrapped into the stimulus. So, it's all just
– it's diluted.
Now it's all just big government New Deal spending and – if you call some of it green, fine, whatever. I guess the rest of it's brown or orange or whatever. It bothers me less.
Interestingly, and they talked about that, I talked about a number of things. Like they mentioned weatherization projects, and that's – I thought that caught my eye because that's something you can do immediately. Some of these things are long-term projects, and we're talking about a recession that could last until 2010. That's why you see Borisov talking about not just substantial but sustained. These are not something to just prevent a, two-quarter recession. We're talking about a potential three-year recession.
Are weatherizing buildings, is that considered sustained investment?
No, that's something that would be more short-term.
Okay.
You could weatherize things now.
So wait, are you for or against weatherizing?
I'm sorry?
You're for or against weatherizing?
I'm for it. I'm saying that it's interesting that there's going to be a combination here of things that I suspect you will see the impact of immediately. It's not like weatherization is not something that requires you know, more technology or R&D. Just a question of, you know, like I've mentioned before, my own home, my state of Massachusetts subsidized my weatherization 50%.
So basically you're for everything. You're for both sustained spending that's going to be sustained and renewable, but also stuff that's going to be short term, like weatherizing, just as long as all it's done wisely.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so that speak to what, you know, Bowers was talking about before. If you can do stuff that's going to be felt in a positive way immediately, that's going to help you politically in 2010 and maintain support for a longer term strategy. And if that stuff is working well, and the right is planting its flag on libertarian populism, you know, that's going to put them out in the cold. If this stuff is not executed well, and you get more of like a, you know, a big dig situation where there's a lot of cost overruns and safety problems and things like that, then it's going to blow up in everybody's face.
Yeah,
so this is very high stakes.
Right. No, I mean, you talk about the big dig, and of course they just opened the Capitol's Visitor Center, which, you know, initially was only going to cost $90 million, ended up costing $630 million, and, you know, it took forever to build. And I guess, you know, if the Democratic Party's future rests on whether or not all this infrastructure spending is going to come on time, not overly budgeted, and be free of political scandal, I'm willing to take that bet. I'll go ahead and read a Greg Mankiw post, which is on point. He says, one thing all economists agree on: if there are public investment projects that pay a high rate of return, those are worth paying for, even if it means borrowing. But that is always true. Even if we were at full employment and there were no possible employment effects or fiscal stimulus, we should undertake public investments that pass a cost-benefit test. In this regard, two observations come to mind. First, since most infrastructure is used locally, the proper level of spending is best determined by state and local governments rather than by the federal government. And Heritage has done a lot of work on how states can best reform their own procurement systems to make sure that they're making transportation infrastructure done wisely. Second, Mankiw writes, more public projects would pass a cost-benefit test if we replace the Davis-Bacon Act. This law requires contractors on these public projects to pay prevailing wages, which are typically union wages well in excess of what could occur in a free market. If the government paid market-determined wages for infrastructure projects, we could have both more infrastructure and less government debt. Without debt, the legacy would benefit future generations.
Well, interesting. I wasn't prepared to talk with this, but Ryan Avent, who blogs at The Bellows, I think it's the same post you're talking about. The point about state and local governments being better for public investment than federal.
Yes, that's been a long Heritage position.
Ryan Avent says, this seems like the kind of thing Greg Mankiw might want to justify rather than simply assert. I can think of about 10 different ways this doesn't stand up to scrutiny. First and most obviously, quality interstate transportation is economically important. Absent federal coordination of infrastructure spending, we would probably see suboptimal investment in such transport. It doesn't do a state much good to build a high-speed rail line or new freight capacity up to its border and no further. He goes on for a little bit more. So, yeah, I think I'm sure there are certain examples where that's true, but there are certain things that you need to have federal support, coordination, high-speed rail being one, smart electrical grid being another.
Yeah, but so much of the infrastructure as far as bridges, roads, especially the stuff you're talking about, light rail, that's all going to be within cities, which, you know, except for DC, which we have here, are generally, you know, within a state.
And I don't get the impression from what Obama was saying, for example, at the Governors Association meeting this week, that he's looking to micromanage stuff like that. He's looking to the governor specifically and saying, you know, you have a better sense of what projects are shovel-ready and are needed to help your state, and I'm looking to you to help design those plans. So he's looking for those state partnerships and looking to help subsidize them, but not have it be overly micromanaged.
Yeah, well, we'll see what Nancy puts on his desk on January 20th.
We will see.
I just wanted to mention one other post, this one by Matthew Continetti, who was on Blogging Heads earlier this week. But he was taking on a Paul Krugman column. Krugman was citing two ideas about when there was a liquidity trap in the past. And Matthew block quotes Krugman. The first took place in 1937 when Franklin Roosevelt mistakenly heeded the advice of his own era's deficit warriors. He sharply reduced government spending, among other things, cutting the Works Progress Administration half.
Are we doing New Deal stuff?
Yeah, just this one post.
Oh, are we still on this? Are you still trying to pretend the New Deal didn't work?
You're cutting me off. This is Krugman admitting the New Deal didn't work and explaining why.
Well, Krugman's argument was the New Deal wasn't progressive enough.
Right. Will you just at least let me finish the post?
Okay.
He sharply reduced government spending. This is Krugman's words still. He sharply reduced government spending, among other things, cutting the worst part of his administration in half, and also, and then this is what Consonetti bolds out of Krugman, raised taxes. The result was a severe recession and a steep fall in private investment. Still Krugman, the second episode took place 60 years later in Japan. In 1996-1997, the Japanese government tried to balance its budget, cutting spending, and again, Consonetti bolds this part, raising taxes. And again, the recession that followed led to a steep fall in private investment. Matthew then comments, so in both cases, the government cut spending and prolonged recession. But that's not all. In both cases, the government also raised taxes and prolonged recession. Funny, Krugman doesn't focus much or at all on this part of the evidence. And Matt concludes, the chances that the Bush tax cuts remain in place after 2010 just got a little bit higher, which I thought was noteworthy since we have heard official word from the Obama administration that if there are going to be raises on taxes, it's not going to come until 2010 when the Bush tax cuts expire. So he's already pulled back on the raising taxes.
Fairly minor pullback. It's not something that really undermines the overall direction he campaigned on and still plans to go in.
It's hundreds of billions of dollars of minorness.
Whether it's done in 2009 or 2011, I mean, it's not dramatically different. It's a question of what's the best time to execute that one component of the policy.
Okay, it's still hundreds of billions of dollars of minorness. So I guess we'll just disagree on what the definition of minor is.
I think what year that is done in is a minor point. I mean, potentially maybe important as far as getting out of the recession is concerned, but not, I don't think it's an example of reversal of policy or breaking of promises. That is way overstating what year that is. I just think
it's a great acknowledgement that we don't want to be raising taxes. On the brink and or of during a recession.
Well, it's a fairly Keynesian point that in times of recession, you want to cut taxes and raise spending and put deficit concerns aside, which is very different than the conservative argument, which is regardless of economic condition, we can always justify a reason for tax cuts on the wealthy.
Well, we like tax cuts for everyone, specifically capital gains tax cuts.
Of course.
But
as long as they're proportionally more for the wealthy.
While we're still on the economy, did you want to – you had some posts on the auto bailout you want to talk about.
Well, auto bailout is hot, complicated, maddening, but pretty serious stuff. I have to say I would argue in general that this is probably an issue that cuts across ideological lines. I don't think it is a unanimous – liberal opinion to be for the bailout. There's certainly plenty of liberals that are none too happy with the big three. These are folks that fought, green rules and did not invest in electric cars. GM killed the electric car at one point. Not all that keen about putting government money behind them. But there's a different argument, of course, from the left that there's a million plus jobs at stake here. Certainly not the right time to see such a massive collapse of a manufacturing industry, good union jobs that are at stake, and we need these factories to build these electric cars, and that could be part of a deal of any kind of bailout. And as far as the blogging I've seen, I've generally only seen more pro-rescue posts. I haven't seen as many anti on the left. So what I have seen, Marcy Wheeler at Empty Wheel, she's been on top of this for a long time. She had one post in particular that talked about the importance of dealerships and all this. She doesn't refer to them as the big three. She calls them the big 2.5 because GM and Chrysler effectively being 1.5. The big 2.5 bailout will help in one way because it'll get credit flowing again to dealers and to consumers. But consumer spending, especially on big ticket items like cars, is down significantly. Until people are buying cars again in big numbers again, dealers are going to continue to go under. I'll be curious this week whether a couple weeks back home of watching dealerships struggle will help convince Congress that this crunch will affect more than just Michigan and Ohio, because in many respects it's been a regional breakdown in Congress where GM, Ford, and Chrysler factories are. Jonathan Tessini at Working Life, who's a UAW member, he's been great at debunking a lot of the myths that have been put out about what workers make and what their benefits are. And he was not thrilled at the concessions that the UAW just took. And he said just today, think about this. It took decades to build a basic living standard that turned crappy industrial jobs into jobs that provided some measure of security. In just a few years, it has unraveled. The danger here is a larger one than just the painful future facing UAW members. I'm clear that the concessions agreed to is all about saving industry that, A, was and is run by incompetent managers, and, B, is suffering from a much broader collapse of the global economy. Even domestic auto sales in Italy are down 30%, so this isn't simply about an American-based auto industry. And this is not about conceding to the idea that auto workers live some gold-plated lifestyle. If we don't make that clear, then the path to Walmart jobs is pretty obvious. Every company will now use the rap, well, even auto workers are agreeing to cut their wages and benefits, and we can't let them do that. I'd also just note briefly, Balloon Juice, John Cole, had a good post about the new look of union busting, referring to Mitt Romney's recent op-ed. When Mitt Romney says a new direction for unions, new direction means planned obsolescence. It's important to remember what Mitt Romney does to make his money. And when he gives advice to what should happen to the auto industry, you need to understand that his vision for America is more of the same in his worldview. Everyone working for $8 an hour at Walmart, getting their health care from Medicare and Medicaid and barely making it. There's been a decent push, I think, in the liberal blogosphere to get some facts out about what the actual salaries and benefit packages are. I don't think it has succeeded in overly influencing the mainstream media, because you see a number of posts, Media Matters, Art Levy, Huffington Post, and others talking about how the $70 an hour line, which was debunked by a number of folks, including Felix Salmon at Portfolio Magazine, still gets repeated. But there has been some interesting blogging nevertheless.
Yeah, well, I guess I'd say, you know, I do think that $70 an hour line is accurate, because, you know, those costs are part of the labor contract, which is the reality that the big three have to work with.
It's not accurate to lump in retiree costs to hourly salary, number one. And number two, you know, a lot of talk about pensions. There was a Wall Street Journal article 2 years ago that both Tessini and David Sorta blogged about at the time, that the workers' pensions were set aside in a fund that was making money and offsetting the costs, whereas the executive pensions, the CEO pensions, were not in such a fund, and those are the pensions that were directly dragging down the bottom line. And in that 2006 story, when GM said, well, you know, these pension costs add $800 to every car, and the Wall Street Journal said, well, are those your pensions or are the workers' pensions? GM wouldn't answer, because they were keeping secret what the proportion of their own pensions were. So again, there's a lot of misinformation about that, and I'm sure Heritage has absolutely nothing to do with any of that.
Oh no, we put out one of those $70 numbers, and we stand 100% by it. We'll link to our study and
we'll link away
and
we'll
on
link
our graphic, and people can decide for themselves how accurate it is. Do you think the auto bailout will be passed by this Congress or the next one?
Honestly, I don't know. I mean, clearly I think it's important we do something and do it as well as possible. It's obviously it's a hard sell when, you know, their management has been terrible.
So do you think it's going to be folded into that massive stimulus bill we've been talking about in January?
It's very hard to game out, and there's obviously a concern that these companies won't make it until January 20th for that bill to be signed. I mean, that's where people are on sort of pins and needles right now.
Well, GM's the only one who says they're not going to make it till January 20th, and most people think
that potentially drags down the rest of them. Even though Ford's in better shape on paper.
Yeah, Ford and Chrysler said they're fine. GM's the only one that's saying that they will die by January 20th or before.
There's a reason why they're doing this in concert. You know, there's a reason why Ford isn't saying, screw off, GM, we're fine, because they realize they have a lot of intermingled assets, things like suppliers and the like, where if one company goes down, it drags down the whole bunch. So we'll see. It's not polling well. The managers did a terrible job in their first hearing. They were tonally off. They're trying to make amends. But and I think what you've heard from Congress people is, you know, we need Bush and Obama on the phones, which is such as we need someone above us to twist our arms and tell us that this is really do or die. And I don't know, I can't predict if they're going to do that now. I mean, obviously, Bush is far less inclined to do it than Obama is.
Well, I got a question for you. But first, you know, yeah. Let me just report that the opinion on the conservative blogosphere is pretty much unanimous, 100% against the bailout.
Sure.
Jim Manzi at the corner, who has a consultant background, looked.
Isn't he one of those guys that kept saying that we're not in recession?
I don't know. Anyways, he took a look at the GM restructuring plan, and this is what he wrote. I've been working my way through GM's much-heralded restructuring plan that is being submitted to Congress tomorrow. There's a lot less work than I thought it might be. It makes at least one point very effectively. GM has an incredible short-term cash problem. While I'm skeptical of bankruptcy in the next 27 days, which GM claims will happen without a $4 billion government cash infusion by the end of the month, it is surely true that at current course and speed, this company is going to run out of money within a few months. And even worse, if we look out over the next 6 to 9 months, it's very discouraging, even if they get the bailout. However, even if GM got the loans, and if we had a decent customer auto purchase for the next year or two, and if GM is able to improve its operations sufficiently, then they could squeak by. The point of the stock was supposed to be the presentation of the plan to achieve these operational improvements. But there's no there. I guess somebody who's never read a real business plan might mistake this document for one, but it's a joke. It's basically a list of assertions of amazing improvements, entirely discontinuous with actual performance to date, that they will achieve. What's missing is any real indication of how they will go about accomplishing this. Now, the most obvious response to all this is to say that I'm the fish at this table, because this is not a real business plan, but simply a political document. It exists to provide political cover to members of Congress. But if that's the case, it's an unintentionally beautiful illustration of why industrial policy fails. It's both economically crucial and very hard to allocate capital well. That's why people who are good at it make so much money. Business struggle to do well, to do this well, and they're all really trying. What do you think the odds are that this is a wise use of money when the people involved are barely pretending to try? So I guess my question after that is, you know, this money is going to be wrapped into whatever economic stimulus it has, and we just got through saying that the stimulus is only going to work if it's spent wisely. So I guess my question is, you know, with all the problems the left has with the way GM's have run in the past, do you think this is a wise investment that the taxpayer should be making?
I mean, I think that's a very difficult call.
Let me put it to you more frankly then. Our first part of this conversation was saying that the Democratic brand is going to rise or fall on how well the Democrats repair the economy.
I guess
my question is, knowing that, do you think the auto bailout is a good or bad bet for the Democrats?
I think that's a very hard question to answer. I think it has to be structured the right way. I mean, I'm more inclined
one's arguing that should be structured the wrong way.
Let me answer the question here. I'm trying to give you the best answer I can. I'm inclined to say that it's a question of, you know, what are your better of bad options. So I can't be as sure that's going to work out fantastically, but I'm quite sure that if you let it just, you know, completely go kaput, and you add, you know, a million new lost jobs into your recession, that strikes me as obviously disastrous. So then it's a question of how do you structure this in the best possible way so that it does work and it can be something that doesn't lose taxpayers' money but allows companies to recover and pay the money back over time. So I can't easily answer that knowing what all the details are and seeing how it's executed. Jim Manzi, who pretty sure I don't have any respect for if I'm thinking of the right person as far as economic insight. But I did see on CNN Mark Zandel, who's from economy.com, who was also testifying today at Congress. He was saying, look, I don't think this is $34 billion. I think it's going to be a bigger number than that. So don't kid yourself. But I do think these plans allow for long-term viability if you stay on top of them and they stick to the script.
Well,
there's someone out there, an independent observer, saying that this can be done well. So I think it's possible, and I'm sure that if it was up to, you know, Obama's, you know, choice, this would not be the first package out of the box because you're cleaning up a giant, giant mess and not doing more bold and exciting things like high-speed rail.
Well, you were asking before what the GOP critique is going to be in the coming years and how this libertarian populism is going to play out. And this is how, is that Democrats are going to have the government running large sections of the economy, like the auto industry, and they're going to keep failing and keep not succeeding and keep coming back to the Capitol Hill for more and more money and more bailouts. And all the time, Republicans are going to be saying, look at those jokers. It's corporate welfare. We need to get the government out of all this. We need to stop the bailouts. We need to stop all this spending and, you know, let America be America again and let the market work. And, we're going to find out. Democrats are going to bet that all their government infrastructure spending is going to come on time, under budget, and free of government corruption. And GM's going to turn around for the first time in the last 30 years, and all of a sudden magically become profitable. And the Republicans are going to take the opposite bet, and we'll see how that plays out.
We will see. Let's say if they do bail out the auto industry and the companies
they'll get their money.
What's that?
They'll get their money. Obama will give them the money.
But if it's done and it is done well, I mean, this I think is a I am more inherently confident that you can do public investment into green technology, high speed rail.
Well, we would hope so. If you weren't, you'd be a Republican.
Right. taking a calamitous auto company that's been running to the ground over decades, and having to retool it to meet the needs of the 21st century, that's a much harder job, and that's not what anyone would like to do. It's cleaning up a giant mess. But you get involved in politics to govern and deal with messes, and so that's what that's the job they've taken on, and that's why I imagine they will likely do it, even though the polling of it on it is terrible, because they believe that they don't do it, the ramifications will be much worse.
Well, good luck running GM.
there was a proposal out there by Dan Neal, the LA Times, to temporarily nationalize GM. That'd be a lot cheaper to buy the stock where it's at now. You could do that for $3 billion as opposed to $34. And this was done with Conrail in the 70s and 80s. It was temporarily nationalized. They got it. They fixed it up, and then they sold it off once the job was done. So it's a decent argument. I haven't seen that argument get made in any seriousness on Capitol Hill. But when we're dealing with choice between bad options, I wonder if there's a stalemate there of an argument like that might end up getting more currency.
It might, but not from our side. So before we close out here, Matt and Ross already touched on this last week, and Chris Hayes and Matthew Continetti already touched on it on Monday. What do you think of the Obama appointment so far? Which are your favorites? Which are your least favorites?
Well, I personally have taken the tack that's more about policy than personnel. Not every personnel choice would be my choice, but all the policy that Obama's talked about so far, whether it's an economic recovery plan, whether it's being following through on having a real cap and trade, a global warming plan, closing down Gitmo, and the like, there's been no serious walking back of any policy proposal from Obama in this transition period. So if he's going to have people who are less liberal than me execute these liberal progressive ideas, that's fine with me. Not everyone has that attitude. I think there's a range of opinions in the blogosphere about it. I saw differing views from Chris Hayes at The Nation versus Spencer Ackerman at Fire Dog Lake. Chris Hayes was lamenting that there weren't enough progressive movement members being picked. Ackerman was saying, hey, having keeping Bob Gates as Secretary of Defense was a masterstroke because now you're giving the wind down of the Iraq war a Republican sheen, and it was going to help him maintain good relationship with the rest of the Pentagon.
Yes, my lost blogging heads with Ari, we touched on that post and how I almost had a heart attack when I read it because actually that's not true. What I said was, if I had read that post 6 months ago, I would have probably killed over the heart attack. But General Ray Ordinero and Petraeus have both spoken at Heritage. And General Petraeus' speech in particular when we posted the video. It was the most incoming lefty traffic from like TPM, Fire Dog Lake, Spencer Ackman that we've gotten in a long time. This was still during the election. And so they were all picking out the Petraeus part where he was talking about, working with elements that we did not work with before in Iraq, and that their line was that, this endorsed the Obama talk to your enemies approach to foreign policy. But it was all positive. So after that incident, I was like, I definitely see how, the Obama and the left is going to become very comfortable with a very flexible troop withdrawal timeline in Iraq and how Gates fits into that.
Well, keep in mind, there are a number of us who complained during the primary that Obama and Clinton Edwards are not taking the Bill Richardson position
right.
of complete withdrawal.
Bowers loudest of all.
Right, and that argument did not carry the day in the Democratic primary, did not carry the day in even the most liberal primary states. So that argument, it's weird, this notion. I saw there's a Times story today that, Obama is walking away from this end the war position. That's going to infuriate liberal supporters. And, this argument was had, and Obama won it on the argument that there should be residual forces. So I don't think anyone's going to be all that shocked.
Yes and no. Not everybody pays as close attention as you, me, and Chris Bowers. I think there are a number of people who will be somewhat surprised at the direction and tone that Obama has.
People will be surprised if at the end of 4 years there is a lot of bloodshed going on, because there's a generic promise that I will end this war.
Well, there's for the past two, three months there's been no bloodshed. So if there's a significant increase of bloodshed in Iraq, it's at this point, it's no longer not going to be good for George Bush. It's going to be bad for Obama.
You still can't quite just take a leisurely stroll down the street in Iraq. There's still violence there. But if things stay the same or get worse, then obviously it's that fundamental premise, I will end this war, that Obama's going to be held accountable on. If there is still a residual force there in a peaceful setting. I mean, Obama's talking about taking out combat forces within 16 months. He never said he would take out all forces. So if you have non-combat forces still there in 2012 and things are still going along in a smooth way, there's not going to be any kind of disgruntlement on the left, because most of the left accepted that in the first place, even though some elements of the left did not.
Yeah, I guess my takeaway, and then we're getting too much in the weeds in Iraq, I wanted to keep it on appointments. My takeaway would be I think you don't realize the extent to which Obama now owns Iraq, and that if he hopes to survive at all, it better stay the same or get better. If it gets worse, I don't think it will, but if it gets worse, that will be very bad for him.
I'm in complete agreement with that point.
But it's very, very rare I get to 100% agree with the Glenn Greenwald post, so I wanted to read it.
Okay.
And this is back from November 23rd, but Glenn writes, I've been genuinely mystified by the disappointment and surprise being expressed by many liberals over the fact that Obama's most significant appointments thus far are composed of pure Beltway establishment figures drawn from the center-right of the Democratic Party, and probably once he names Defense Secretary and CIA Director, even from the Bush administration, but not from the left. None of them are liberals. But then Obama said repeatedly that he was not ideological, that he cared about, quote, what works. I don't know why people didn't believe that. He's a technocrat who wants to, quote, solve problems and, quote, change politics. The first may actually end up producing the kind of ideological shift liberals desire simply because of the dire set of circumstances greeting the new administration. The second was always an empty fantasy. Politics is just another word for human nature, and that hasn't changed since we were dancing around the fire outside our caves. At that point, I said, yeah, huh, you go, Glenn.
Well, over the course of the past year, we had this argument in the past. I repeatedly kept trying to convey to you that a lot of liberal bloggers, not everybody, but a lot of the more notable liberal bloggers were never on the Obama bandwagon. Even though Coase was, not Coase the person, but Coase the community, was pretty strongly for Obama relatively early, and a lot of people looked at that as saying Obama has the net roots. It was always evident that a number of bloggers were always kept Obama at an arm's length, never liked the bipartisan rhetoric that he based a lot of his campaign on. And so it's folks like Greenwald and like Jane Hampshire, Fire Dog Lake, and some others who are saying, "I told you so," now, and not that they're surprised at all. But you know, these are.
I think you made a good distinction there, because I think you're right. I mean, when I worked for National Journal, I covered this, and I wrote many spotlights articles on how there definitely was a lot of consternation over Obama's true positions and the tone he was taking. Particularly the bipartisan part of it, in the leadership, not all, but a lot of the leading members of the progressive movement. But I think you're right to make a distinction that the Coast community, and I think the larger progressive blogosphere, the leadership definitely bought hook, line, and sinker this, change we believe in. Obama's, the dawning of a new age. He's going to lower the sea levels, et cetera, et cetera. Rhetoric and story. And I do think those people are in for surprise and disappointment.
Well, I don't think there's definitely, and you're seeing a little bit of this in the blogosphere now, where some bloggers who have been skeptical of Obama are being critical of other bloggers who are being more diehard Obama. Both Greenwald made that point. Sirota, who's put up some critical posts about Obama, has been trying to stress, hey, we can't have a strong progressive movement community if we can't dissent about anything, so don't beat me up if I make my point critical. But there's this, liberals had a tendency to oversimplify the right, to treat the right are a bunch of sheep. They're all top down. They do whatever Karl Rove and their masters tell them to do, when it's a more diverse movement than we gave it credit for. And the left is the same way. There's diversity of view. There's some people who like the fact. There are liberals who like the fact that Obama made these picks. They like the pragmatic element to it. You have, in the most recent Gallup poll, 94% approval from Democrats about how Obama's handling his transition. That obviously is going to include a lot of self-described liberals. So it's not that people are going to be surprised. It's that the range of view within the left is more diverse than people on the outside give it credit for.
All true. I think the ultimate takeaway from this week in blog is that it's all going to turn on how the economy turns out and how what the Obama administration actually does and what his policies do, not so much the personnel.
It tends to be that
way. Okay. Good place to end it, Bill.
Great to talk to you.
Talk to you next week.
Take care.